Hi, my name is Justin Slocum, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for the warm welcome and for inviting me out to share tonight. It's good to see some familiar faces, people I see all around. Billy was sharing, I like to go out to AA events whenever I can and when I'm not working and meet people from out of town, but also just to hear all the great speakers in the fellowship, because we're in a the conference that's coming up, the Pockets of Enthusiasm, what you mentioned. I believe this area is a pocket of enthusiasm. Every meeting I go to, I always get a warm welcome, whether I'm brand new, been around, or anything like that. And not to mention, it's a beautiful day to drive out here from Richmond. So I'm going to get started with, I got specific instructions from my sponsor, and that was to tell the truth. So I can manage that. I think I can muster up that. But I'll tell you a little bit about what I used to be like. But first I'm going to go into my home group is the Jaywalkers in Huguenot Road. We're in Bon Air, right outside of Richmond, actually. And we meet on Tuesdays and Fridays. So if you're ever in Richmond and you're looking for a place to go, we meet on Tuesdays at 7:30 and on Fridays at 7 p.m. And I've been a home group member there since 2005. My sobriety date's February 7th of 2008. So, there's a little misconstrued date there, but I can even show you my original sobriety date was December 7th of 1995 until the year 2003. So there's a little, veering away from the program, I guess you could say, as a part of my story. And it's only by the grace of God and in the wonderful 12 steppers that God put in my way when I was scraping bottom for the second time, and they were put in my path, because I couldn't find the courage to make it back in here on my own, evidently, because the first time I came in here out of desperation. The second time I came in here just out of pure shame, just basically beaten down and really just afraid, but as you can tell probably from my accent, I'm not from, Virginia. I grew up in Connecticut, and that's where I was born, in Greenwich Hospital. And my parents were together till I was about 3. And the last memories of them being together, we were caretakers on this large estate, We lived in this little house, little caretaker bungalow on this estate. And the gentleman who owned the estate, he had several horses, and it was I don't know what you'd call it, but an estate for sure. It was a beautiful area, Eastern Connecticut. And but the last I remember of my parents being together, I was sleeping out in the stables in this little room in the back with my father, and I asked him, and we were watching black and white TV, and it was like The Honeymooners on at 11 o'clock at night or something like that, and I asked my dad, I said, why are we sleeping out here? Why aren't we in the house? And he says, well, things aren't going so well. And then I didn't see my dad for a couple of years after that. Turns out he left for Spain and did his little shindig in Spain and came back and moved to Lynchburg, Virginia. And that's when I started coming down to Virginia in the summertime to visit with my father. It wasn't too frequent, but I did get to see him, enough. But I guess from that point on, I felt not too much emotion about my parents splitting up or anything, but my mother had met another gentleman when I was 5, and he became my stepfather. He was a Vietnam vet from the Marines, and excellent role model, I pretty much lived a pretty happy life as a kid. I didn't, wasn't abused or anything. I have no reason to be an alcoholic or be standing before you telling you, why I had a reason to pick up my first drink. I think, I was just, a kid who was looking to feel more comfortable with myself. I didn't like feeling quirky. I didn't like feeling out of place. I went to 3 different elementary schools because my mother and I, we ended up moving around, and then we moved in with Carl, my stepfather, and then we moved again. And so through that process, I ended up going to 3 different elementary schools, 2 different middle schools, and 2 different high schools. So I was always meeting new kids. I was always the new kid in class, it seemed like, every other year at least. And that in itself is a challenge for a kid, and I don't like it. I don't like being the new kid. I like coming in, fitting in, and knowing where I belong right from the start. And I like to be liked, of course. You know, I want to be accepted and liked. And I think the only struggle for me was that I probably got into a few more fights than I like to admit as a kid. And it usually was with the kids that I befriended with and became close to. I don't know why. But I look at that, and that's just part of my inventory. And the blessing was is that one of the guys that was one of my best friends as a kid, he was one of those guys on my men's list, and he was like in my mind for the past several months. And this is like 25 years later, and who tries to send a friend request through Facebook is this guy who I haven't seen in 25 years, and it gave me that opportunity, but. And things aren't as bad as I imagined. That's basically what it boils down to. Is when I put that forth and tried to write all that, he didn't even think twice. He's like, we were just kids. We were just roughhousing. So, anyways, I'll get to my first drink. That was the first one I can remember. I can tell you that my grandparents raised me for the most part when my parents split up. From the time I was 3 till I was about 6, my grandfather was like my male role model. My grandmother was the one that was there for me when I got home from school because my mother was a full-time worker and she went to school at night. So I was real close to my grandparents. And, you know, at 3 o'clock, grandma was always a little bit fidgety, a little bit grumpy. And by 5 o'clock, 5:30, when dinner was ready, she always had this cheerful smile on her face. And you know, when I kissed my grandmother, she always had this certain, you know, taste and smell about her breath. And I never really recognized what that was, but it was scotch. After years of coming into AA, I was like, that's what grandma, that's why she was a little bit fidgety and cranky at 3, and that's why she was perfectly content and giggly at 5. So, I don't know whether or not, you know, it's anything hereditary, but, you know, probably skips a few generations. I had a grandfather on my father's side who died of cirrhosis of the liver. He drank himself to death before he was 35, so nobody, you know, my father didn't really even get close to him. But my mother's not a drunk. My father's not, you know, no, never, you know, really. There was some heavy drinking probably that I know of, but I never really witnessed anything like that. My mother's always been the one to have like a screwdriver, you know, that was her drink, and by the second one, she was tipsy-topsy and giggly, and I've had enough, I'm getting ready to go to bed. And my first drunk one was when I was 13, after, you know, sneaking a couple of shots from Grandma's liquor cabinet and taking Grandpa's Schaefer beer out of the fridge, I would sneak one of those, you know, they don't make that but anymore, I guess, but that's what he drank, and I got to that party at Karina Robinson's. She was one of the cute little cheerleaders, one of the most popular girls in the school that I was brand new at in seventh grade, of course. And I didn't fit in with any of those kids in the class. But I had my two best friends, my little cronies, Peter and Paul, and we'd gotten into smoking weed and all that. And we go into this party, and of course, you know, I didn't fit in with the jocks or the preppies because we had the little cliques that were starting to develop in seventh grade. I don't know about you, but we had them in our school, and they were pretty clear cut. You'd walk into the school, you'd know who was with who, and you know the popular crowd. Now, I didn't really think too much of it. I just felt a little uncomfortable when I walked in the door. That's all I remember. And when we got into the kitchen, there was the liquor cabinet. Wide open, you know. I don't remember if it had a lock on it or what, but we said, can we have some, you know? And Karina says, just don't take too much because my parents are away for the weekend and, you know, I don't want them knowing that we drank the liquor, but you guys can have, you know. And so we took the bottle of vodka and the 2-liter of Diet Coke and yeah, the most vile, disgusting combination you can imagine. Okay, warm, no ice. We were not bartenders by any means yet, and you know, 4 fingers of vodka, 2 fingers of Diet Coke. We didn't know ratio, but you know, we figured, well, this is alcohol. This is what we're supposed to drink, and you know, pour a little bit of the rest in, and it just was the most disgusting thing I could ever imagine. It burned going down, and I mean, I choked it down literally, and I finally choked the whole glass down, and I had to gulp the last bit because I mean, I couldn't stand it. And then about a minute later, I mean, I could feel the warming effect inside me, and all of a sudden this wash came over me, and I just didn't care about all the other kids. I didn't care whether they liked me or not. And the next thing was, like, let's pour me another, and I guess I drank four or five of those, and I remember the third one, and then after that I don't remember anything, because I guess I went out in the yard, knocked myself unconscious playing football in the front yard, and landed on a rock, and, you know, when I came to, I was looking up at the ceiling, and I was wearing different clothes, and somebody was holding my head saying, it's going to be all right, and I was like, whose clothes are these? And Karina, the hostess, who's like, these are my brothers, you know, you puked all over the place, and I was like, oh, great, I made a good impression, you know. I get, you know, I was ashamed and embarrassed, but I was too drunk to really let that set in, so as soon as I can get on my own 2 feet, I was out and about and running around the party again. And you know, Monday came around that day. Monday, seeing all the other classmates, you know, there was a little shame and embarrassment masked over with the determination to be able to not make a fool out of myself the next time I drank. You see, the next time I drank, though, was probably 3-4 months later, because I could not smell, taste, or take any of that. I mean, if I did, I think I probably got alcohol poisoning from that first night. I'm almost positive. I mean, I didn't go see a doctor, but I woke up the next day, I was shaky, you know, queasy. I mean, shaky. After the first night, I had an unlimited amount of alcohol at my disposal. So, but that didn't throw up any warning signs to me. The only warning sign for me was that I just need to learn how to cut back and get to that point where I'm at the happy buzz, and then, you know, not drink past that, you know, that's all I need to do, and then I'm an adult, and I can drink like big people. So for the next 3 years, I managed to, you know, get all my bumps and bruises, you know, pass out in the front doorsteps, you know, cops called my parents from, you know, the parties where I was getting, you know, picked up for underage drinking, and getting hauled down to the police station for drinking in public, and falling down a couple of flights of steps and knocking myself unconscious at my mother's house to, you know, in her horror, she woke me up from being in a passed out state at the top step of our condo, and there was about 32 steps all the way down to a slate patio, and she woke me up finally, and I got up, and, you know, of course, I was like a wobble, but I did fall down, and I back somersaulted all the way back down there, and I, you know, swore up and down to the EMTs that I'd only had one, and I was a good drunk from the beginning. I knew how to lie, but I mean, it was the most ridiculous lies I would come up with. So I knew for a fact that my mother was probably horrified. So her remedy for that was to allow me to drink when we did go out to dinner. She would allow me to have one or two drinks at dinner time if we did go out, and it was a special occasion. Of course, the drinks that I chose were the ones that had 4 and 5 liquors in them. You know, you name it. Long Island iced tea, kamikaze, anything. Anything that had lots of shots in it. And by the time the entree, you know, I would want to order a second. I would always try and wait till she was distracted, and I would tell the waiter. And they weren't too strict about carding back then, or at least where I was. So I would try and sneak another in. But the obsession to drink was there. By the time I had reached high school and I was in 10th grade, you know, I was pretty determined to drink whenever and however I could. So I was always planning on, you know, how I was going to get some, how much I was going to have. You know, I was already practicing taking the beers and putting them back behind the lettuce crispers at parties, because I'd be counting out how many beers were in the fridge, and I'd count out how many people there were, and I'm like, there's not enough for me, and I'm taking mine and hiding it and taking it outside and ditching it, you know, so we don't run out. I was always concerned with supply, because I had a lot of demand, and I knew how much it took to get me where I needed to go, and, you know, even, I don't care if I didn't buy it, it was still, you know, by all means, what was, you know, I needed it, you know, and so there was a lot of, there's a lot of outside, you know, I identified myself as an alcoholic, and I know I am, and I come into these rooms and I identify myself as an alcoholic. I also went to other fellowship and identified myself as an addict, because there was a lot of drugs in my story. I grew up 30 minutes outside of downtown Manhattan, and it was easier for me to get an 8-ball of cocaine at 15 years old than it was to get a six-pack of beer. I mean, I'm just going to, I mean, it's just demographics. I mean, if I was probably growing up in Franklin County, I probably would have never seen what an eight-ball looked like, and I would have probably been a strict drunk the whole way through. But there was other influences as a teenager growing up, and I always looked for those role models. Unfortunately, they were the ones that were knocking out windows, stealing Blaupunkt stereos from the BMWs down the street. There was, you know, a lot of that element because I lived in a town where there was a lot of wealthy, you know, wealthy families lived there. And, of course, my mother and I, we lived in a modest condominium, and, but that's what I was surrounded by. So, it was always, ample things to get involved in, it seemed like. I did work as a caddy when I was a teenager, and those were role models, and they were the most bizarre, horrible role models I could pick. Was these caddies, you know, these 40 and 50 year old caddies that, you know, slept under park benches. They'd show up at the caddy shack at 6:45 in the morning with a pint of pop off, and I'd be, you know, knocking back the pop off vodka with them, and then I'd go out and caddy for 18 holes and walk away with $120 at 15 years old. That's big money for 1985, you know. And you know, I could go spend it however I wanted to, you know. And so Saturday for me was just like, by 3 o'clock, you know, I could barely walk. I was in the park with Richie and those old drunks and stumbling around and that was that, you know. And quite often it was involved a trip to the South Bronx with, for all that other garbage that I spoke of. But what became of me? Well, I high school was a social event for me. It was where I was going to go to find out what parties were happening next, and I think I did well in the classes that interested me. The other classes, I showed up sometimes, and sometimes I didn't. We weren't real strict in that school about whether you showed up or not. If you wanted to get into a good college, so be it. You show up, you make good grades. If you don't show up, the teachers pretty much overlook that. So I really wasn't reprimanded for my absentee, for being absent in any of the classes. And so by the time I was a junior, I pretty much picked and choose which classes I was going to show up based on who was going out to smoke or drink at during which period. So my attendance was infrequent, and by that time I'd convinced myself the real world is waiting for me out there, and I need to learn how to be a real man, and I'm going to go live in it. So I decided I was going to go follow the Grateful Dead and learn how to live like a real man. So my girlfriend Jean and I, we packed up our stuff, and I brought my knapsack, my sleeping bag, my tent, and I go into school, and I was making this big, you know, announcement to my teachers that I was leaving to go, you know, and I was going to wind up on the West Coast, you know, in sunny California, and I was going to set up shop, and that was that, and I was going to live a happily ever after with my true love. And my teachers, I think they were good sports because they just were like, you know, we wish you the best. You know, I hope you know what you're doing, you know, because I was that kid. I mean, you probably couldn't tell me anything, you know, because I knew it all. You know, I was the worst teenager you could probably ever ask to have as a child. And my mother, God bless her, and I'm still making a living amends to that woman today. And that's the beauty of this program, is it allows me to do that. You know, I stay sober, and you know, she reaps the benefits. So, and it does happen. I did remember her birthday this year, and that didn't happen in the days past. There would be years when I would forget birthdays. I would forget, you know, holidays. Never mind that. You know, I was a teenager that would grin and bear an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours of Thanksgiving before I got sick and tired of you people. I didn't want to hear my grandma nag anymore. I just want to go get drunk with my friends. Where's the party? You know, and I was out the door. So I left for to go on to the Grateful Dead. And 4 months later, through several incidents, we ended up camping out in Cranberry State Park in upstate Connecticut, running from the whoever was chasing us at the time. You know, we had all these, you know, great ideas that got squashed because, I told my family I was selling Mexican blankets, but it was other things that I was selling, and the connection that we had, he ended up going to prison for 10 years, and I thought, well, we're next, so we better go hide out. So that's what we did. And she finally got word after I was living in Cranberry State Park in a tent in the woods for about 2 months, Gene and I, and I was like, well, don't worry, we're going to save up, we're going to get that old Datsun B210 that so-and-so drives around to the park and buys weed once all the time. Well, we're going to buy that thing, and we're going to go out to California like we planned, and it never happened. She shows up at the park one day, I was intoxicated, under the influence of several other drugs, too, and she talked to me and commenced me, asked me to call my father, who I had a resentment against because I felt like he didn't care, he wasn't showing up in my life. That was a tough subject for me. I broke down. I cried. I called my father. I said, you know, he's asking me all these questions. I couldn't answer. I wasn't even in any condition to answer any type of questions. But he says, why don't you come down and live with me? And my friends were waiting in the car. We wanted to go to New York City and go see some concert. So my mind was all over the place. And didn't hear from him. My mother convinced me to come back and stay at the house for a couple days, you know, just to try and get a grasp on reality. Because I wasn't really living in reality. I was delusional. I thought everything was okay, you know, even though things at the tent weren't going so well with Gene, you know. That was my thinking. I thought things were okay. It's going to work out somehow, you know. But literally, our life was just miserable. I mean, it was terrible. I was taking showers in a Friendly's bathroom, okay. And but as a kid, it was an adventure for me, you know. So. You couldn't have told me different until I was, you know, sick and tired of being sick and tired, and that's where it got. And I go to stay with Mom. 3 days later, she hands me a bus ticket to go to my father's because I was there for about maybe a total 4 hours out of that 3 days. I came back home and I was out doing the same thing I always did. And she probably got worried sick of me and she couldn't stay and she couldn't take it. So off I go on a bus and. I show up and my stepsisters are all looking at me funny. You know, I've got this long hair and I'm wearing this scrubby clothes, wearing a tie-dye. And they're like, what happened to you? You know, because 4 years ago when the last time they saw me, I was this nice kid, you know, decent haircut. And I was tucking my shirt in and all that. And here I was, you know, scrubby. And, you know, I've been living in the woods for a couple months. So I straightened out. I did all the things that it took to keep me... under the radar, so to speak, so I could pretty much make it look like I was doing everything I was supposed to, and I was, but I was still doing everything I wasn't supposed to. I was still, I got this part-time job washing dishes, and this was repeating my 11th grade year, to let you know. I was washing dishes at night so I could fix up this Volkswagen Bug my father had given me. He lured me down there. He says, I got this car. You just need a little work. You know, it's a 68 Volkswagen Bug. You like Bug? I'm like, yeah, that's cool. And I get down there. The motor's in the front seat. You can stick your foot through the floorboards, and there's grass growing up through it. I was like, oh, my God. I resented him for that, too. You know what I mean? So it took me a year to put it together, but I saved up my pennies. But every night after I got off of work from washing dishes at this Chinese restaurant, I walked home. And in Lynchburg, I was walking by Lynchburg College. And, of course, you know, the familiarity, you know, half a block away, I could smell the quaff of the beer and the cigarettes and the laughter in the lit porch. You know, and it just lured me, you know, because you could smell the beer from a half a block away, you know. And I mean, I didn't know a soul in there, but I walked in there like I knew everybody, and I shook hands. I said, hey, how you doing? And they said, and grab a beer, and next thing you know, I was part of Angry House, is what the name of the house was called, and which later burned down about 5 years later because somebody fell asleep and it, whatever happened, but... Anyways, that's where I showed up every night, hoping my father was asleep on the couch so he wouldn't see me pinballing from hallway to hallway back to my bedroom. And I managed to get A's and B's. I don't know how I did it, but I did it. And because I did my homework and I did what I was supposed to. I came back to Connecticut and decided I needed to get a career. And I looked into culinary school and got some grants and went into a culinary school so I could learn how to be a chef because it seemed like the thing I couldn't make a decision. So that was it. It was kind of like flipping a coin, you know. And the first year was hell. I really couldn't take it. They made me work 10 hours a day and then do an hour and a half class afterwards. And I mean, it's just all this information that I didn't know. I didn't know how to cook really well at all. I mean, I started a fire in my own house when I was 13 from cooking popcorn, for crying out loud, so you can imagine, you know. I think I got stoned, I lit the stove and put the oil in there and the one popcorn kernel and started watching Tom and Jerry. Next thing you know, boom, you know, it was a huge black mark on the ceiling of our kitchen and, you know, burnt my eyebrows off and everything. I mean, that was my first cooking experience, so you can imagine it was an uphill battle. So, anyways, I get through the first year, which was pure hell, and I managed to not drink. I mean, the town was Montpelier, Vermont, small state capital of the United States, population of 7,000, only one or two, I think one bar. The second bar is in a hotel, so it doesn't count, really. So you really stood out like a sore thumb if you were a daily drinker there, so we had to be like porch drinkers. You know, we'd get our cases of beer and sit on the porch. So for me, it was very low-key, and I managed to get through it. Second year of school, came back, it seemed like a breeze, and so that was the one thing I settled down, buckled down, and completed, and I did get a GED, actually, but in there somewhere when I came back to Connecticut. But after that, I graduated, and I had my choice of anywhere to go in the world. You know, I can put an application for any hotel, fine dining restaurant in the world. I chose San Francisco, of course. You know, the one place where it all happened. So I figured if I go there, I'll be reaching back into the roots, and you know, maybe I'll even meet Jerry Garcia one day. So, what happened is I go out there and I buckle down for about first 5 or 6 months. I seem to be doing okay. You know, everything seems to be in place. On the outside, it looks great. You know, I managed to hold it down. I got my apartment. I had four roommates because out there you got flats. And even back in 1989, you know, a three-bedroom flat in the worst section of town was $1,500 a month. So it was you know, four roommates was average, you know. Five if you're trying to scrape by, you know. But so I had my myself and three others, and one of them was a home brewer, okay? So that made it interesting. We lived right above Donington Park, which was this old English pub. So all I had to do was walk down two flights of steps, and I was at home away from home. So I didn't have to go too far, and I turned 21, and, you know, it was an adventure. It was another adventure. New kid in new city, and as soon as I found those guys that drank like I did, and that were at work at this, I was working at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, and that was where I was started right out of culinary school, and it was a great job, a career job, you know, world-renowned executive chef, and we turned five-star in like 3 months after opening, and I had rotated through the banquets, through the garmanger, into pastries, and I was really getting the solid foundation. I was doing well, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm out with the guys, and we're you know, my buddy's like, you know what, I'm giving up this engagement. We drink this $200 bottle of Chateau Lafite Rothschild at 4 a.m. and smoke a joint, and next thing you know, we're going out to these all-night clubs, and I'm going in there and taking a shower inside of our changing rooms at 6 o'clock in the morning, coming straight in from the bars. And I got a job as a private chef, and this is like the apex, you know. I'm like reaching the apex, you know, where I get this job where all I have to do basically is cook two meals a week, two five-course meals a week for 10 people, and I've got this luxury apartment in a posh section of San Francisco in the Marina District. And I mean, I'm literally right next door. The owner of the San Francisco Giants is our next-door neighbor. I mean, it's a nice neighborhood. And a free apartment, a monthly salary, and I only have to work 15 hours a week. So I have got my full-time job at the Ritz-Carlton, and I'm, you know, making the salary. And, you know, I guess I was 22 by that time. I was probably making somewhere around $50,000 a year, no bills, and I was broke every week. You do the math. You do the math. So, and evidently that was not enough. So I had to supplement my income the way I always did. And that led me to another basket of trouble to get into. And before you knew it, I was, you know, sweaty palms, sitting in a holding cell, calling my mother for help one last time because I'd gotten myself into trouble that I never thought, you know, that I just couldn't see myself getting out of this time because, you know, I was looking at a 10-year sentence and the penitentiary for all this, you know, garbage that I was doing. And, well, make a long story short, I lost both jobs within like a 2-month period, all as a result of my drinking. And what happened after that was a very solid, sudden, quick down spiral. I probably gotten a few jobs scattered around town, and I'd work a week or two, maybe sometimes a day, sometimes 4 hours, and just ditch out on the job, or I'd get fired, or you know, the axe was going to fall. I'd just duck out and pack my stuff and leave, and I became what I called as a couch surfer. You know, I just kind of went from friend's house to friend's house and stayed on the couch, and sometimes I'd get an apartment where they didn't know I was living. The landlord didn't know I was living there until, you know, one day he shows up to do some sort of a, you know, repair on the apartment building, and he's like, "Who are you?" And I've been living there for 4 months in one of his vacant apartments, and so I was living sort of a transient lifestyle, so to speak, and it got to where I was waiting in line at the soup kitchen, and I was collecting food stamps and trading my food stamps in down in the Tenderloin for 80 cents on the dollar with the Mamasan so I can afford my habits, and you know, I didn't dare spend any money on food. That's why I waited in line at the soup kitchen, because all that money was precious and meant for, you know, my drink and everything else that at the time I thought was holding me together and getting me through this tough time. I didn't know it was the cause of my tough time. That delusion was so thick, and the denial was always there. I was getting to the point where, you know, I would wake up in the park in the middle of the town, and some guy would walk by and he'd look at me, and I'd see the look on his face almost in dismay, like, "Do you need some help?" And I'd look at him like insulted, like, "Who are you? You know, why are you asking me if I need?" He's like, "I mean, you don't look so good, you know." And people were taking Polaroid shots of me at a party, and I'd be like pale white, death warmed over, hadn't slept in days, and I was 135 pounds, soaking wet. And this is all after I dodged my charges. What happened was, my probation officer, after going through court, I was sentenced to do 350 community service hours and 5.5 years of probation. And I never showed up to see my probation officer once after that, never went to do 1 minute of community service hours. Although I was fully intended on showing up the next morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, I just was incapable of showing up. You know, because when I left his office that last time, all I could do was want a drink and to extinguish everything, you know, because I wanted to get rid of it all. And I ran, you know, not unconsciously. I didn't run. I just ran, you know. I just didn't ever go back. So there was a warrant out for my arrest for the next couple of years. I was bouncing around on the streets and you know, yeah, it was a nightmare. And for me it was. The pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization kicked in pretty quick. You know, a fully capable 23-year-old, 24-year-old, still, you know, unable to make it to a job interview, unable to stay sober for more than 2 hours in the morning before I was, you know, compelled to take another drink just to ease the pain, to take the edge off, to help me forget, you know, just to get out the door. And then, you know, if I made it 2 blocks down the road, I was already distracted by, well, let me go in the bar and just, you know, get one shot. Or let me go, you know, do the drugs that I was doing. And the combination of the two brought me to my knees pretty quick, and I stayed down there for a while. I mean, it was a reckless bottom. That's all I can say, is that, you know, I became somebody I never thought I'd become, and I started realizing that I couldn't lower my standards quick enough for the company that I kept, and pretty soon the people that I was looking down at, I was looking up at. And I was like, you know, I'd become the person that I thought I'd never become. And the things that I was doing to get through and get by, I mean, just you name it. I mean, I became a thief, a liar, you know, a cheat, anything to get what I needed to get. And when it finally caught up to me, it was a blessing in disguise, you know. I did want to die when I was out there. Every day I woke up, I just felt, you know, that I just didn't want to have another day like this. It wasn't working for me anymore. You know, and God bless the people I hear come in here and they see the bottom before it hits them, you know. God bless them. I mean, if you could stick around when you see the bottom coming, and you can get in here before then, God bless you. But I just have a larger threshold of pain than I'd like to admit. I mean, for me, it's like I'll be scraping the bottom before like, what's all this about? You know, and I'm looking for a trap door to get even lower. But what happens is, you know, there's got to be, you know, and also it has to do with that. I really couldn't accept the fact that I wouldn't ever have control over it. You know, the struggle that one day I was going to be able to wake up and not take a drink that day. I thought that day was going to come for me. I thought I was going to have enough willpower. I didn't have enough willpower to go to treatment when I made the appointments. I made several appointments, of course. But the final appointment was made by the officer who found me up on the fire escape of the CD Hotel off of Market Street. And I told him up and down, I said, look, I have an appointment at 8:30 tomorrow morning, and I'm going into treatment. This is not right. You shouldn't take me to jail because he said, son, you've got a warrant out for your arrest, and with all the paraphernalia that you've got in your knapsack, you're lucky that, you know, you don't get sent away for a long time. I said, well, and that's when I broke down. I said, okay, well, I guess steak's taking over my treatment now. And that's where I went. And I cooled off, and at 135 pounds, soaking wet, I went in there, and I slept for 3 days straight, sweated, puked, and woke up with nightmares and detoxed in jail. And I woke up, and I talked to one of the bunk mates in this cell, you know, where I was sleeping with 15 other guys in San Francisco City Jail. And I said, man, I can't take this. I keep having these dreams where I want to drink, I want to get high, and I can't. There's something missing. You know, either I can't find the bottle or I can't find the, you know, and I was an intravenous drug user for the last 3 years. And I said, I couldn't find either. I just don't know what's going on. He says, maybe God's trying to tell you it's time to stop. And that was the first moment that I experienced, well, maybe there is another option. Maybe I could possibly think about stopping, you know. For me, stopping wasn't on the menu, it was controlling it, you know, finding the perfect magical, you know, mix of how I can get back the job that I once had, or how I could get into the right apartment, or if I had the right girlfriend, or if I got the right mix of things, then I would calm down with the other stuff. But it never happened for me that way. And so in jail, I called up my father and I said, look, I'm trying to get into treatment. I'm going to be here for a while, but I need to, you know, find something, because once I do get out, I'm going to go back to what I was doing before. And there's no other, there's no doubt about it. I mean, there's, you know, for me, I wasn't the person that woke up in the morning with a choice. And I'm sure some of you can probably relate with waking up in the morning knowing that, you know, full and well with your great intentions, just like mine, that, you know, as much as we intend on doing the next right thing and doing the thing that we promised we were going to do yesterday or this morning, you know, by noon or by 3 or 4 o'clock, we'd convince ourselves that it might be okay to have one, you know. And I knew that I was going to, because I had it in my mind that as soon as I get out, I'm going to go out for one more last hoorah. And that hoorah was the scariest hoorah that I can imagine, you know, and it always was. For me, it was always more, I was always biting off more than I could chew, let's put it that way. And he said, well, why don't we go to treatment, you know, why don't I look into treatment here in Virginia? You might have a better chance of staying sober here, because you don't know anybody that's sober out there. And I thought, you're right. I don't know anybody sober. I completely surrounded myself with people that were just as miserable and messed up as I was. And, you know, because anything better would have made me feel, like, inferior. And I didn't like to feel inferior, you know. So I went before the judge, and he released me on the premise that I had this whole treatment thing lined up. I went to outpatient in Lynchburg, Virginia. I took that, you know, flight of shame, you know, in which I took the ticket as soon as I got out of jail, and I took that ticket and I took it to my connection. I had no control. I was that physical compulsion. I took that ticket to my connection, $800 ticket back to Virginia, and I'm like, just give me what I got to, you know, just get me through, you know, because I had 4 days to wait till that plane left. And then when that day came and the plane was getting ready to leave, I couldn't find the guy. And I had the money ready, and I couldn't find him, so I had to make that call. And I was like, you know, I lost my ticket. You know, and it was a lie, too. I had to lie to my mother and tell her I lost the ticket. And I went back. She bought another ticket for me, and I took my one set of clothes that I got out of the lost and found at the jail, because when they got my clothes, they just probably burned them or ditched them, because that's all I had. You know, I'd taken my stuff, and I put it in some guy's storage that I'd went out partying with one weekend, never met before in my life, took all my living room furniture, my TV, my stereo, and gave it to some guy to put in his garage that I'd never met before. That's the kind of life I was living when I was out there. And of course, you know, a year and a half later when I get out of jail, I'm like, you know, I don't know who this guy's name was, you know. I mean, I just took my life and just, you know, just whatever. But I get back to Virginia and I go to this treatment center, and you know, I was miserable. I was clean and sober, and I was working and going to for my 3-hour outpatient in the morning, and then working at this restaurant, and it was this Cajun restaurant in Lynchburg, and sure enough, God put somebody in my life. You know, this guy's working next to me for the past 3 days. You know, we're starting to talk and get to know each other, and he asked me what brought me here from California. He's like, "Why'd you leave California?" You know, and I went from one extreme to the other. I mean, it was like the city of sin to Jerry Falwell's bedroom. You know, it was like, you know, you can imagine what it was like for me. It was like culture shock. I was like, my God, you know, I'm sitting up at like midnight, like, where is everybody? You know, and everybody's asleep by 8 o'clock in that town. And so, you know, I'm sitting there going out of my mind. I'm like, I'm going to save up enough money. I'm going to go back out there. I'm going to be, you know, here I am, you know, 40 pounds heavier, looking healthy, you know. And my nickname in jail was Eat 'Em Up, because after I finally detoxed, I gained 35 pounds in like 2 weeks. And it was like I hadn't eaten in 4 years or something like that. So what happened was this guy asked me, and I said, "Well, you know, I kind of got into some stuff out there, and you know, I'm kind of going to this little this center here." And he says, "What?" You know, I said, "Well, it's kind of like a treatment place." And he says, "Really?" And his eyes lit up, sparkle, and he knew. He just says, "Wow, I get to practice service work today," is what he was thinking. And me, I was like, "Why are you looking at me so funny? Why are you so happy that I screwed my life up?" You know, he's like, "Come on out, let's have a cigarette." So we leave the kitchen, we go out back, and he tells me his story. And then tell you what, this guy had shared so many things that I felt so for so long and I couldn't identify with, you know. And he was pretty much speaking, you know, to me about me, and spoke this language that I just was amazed. And he says, "Well, you know, I go to these meetings, and I've been clean sober for 5.5 years. And why don't you, you know, get yourself ready, and 11:30 tomorrow I'll come pick you up, and we'll take you to my home group." And his home group was the noon meeting downtown. And so he picked me up, and he commenced to take me to meetings every noon before we went to work. And that's my first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. And and that man really did what we're told to do here, and that's where I learned it from. And I'll tell you what, I was dry, I was crazy for the first year. You know, I wouldn't take suggestions. You know, I would go to keg parties because the waitress that I had a crush on was going there, and I thought for sure, you know, because she invited me, you know, that there was a reason I had to be there. You know, and when I found out that her boyfriend, who was this millionaire, came up and kissed her, I mean, I couldn't take that. I had to have a drink, and sure enough, I, you know, got drunk, wet my pants, game went late for work, and that was God's way of showing me that that's probably not a good idea, you know. Drinking's not a good idea anymore. It's probably not supposed to be on the menu, you know what? Maybe that's why they say don't drink and go to meetings, but who knows? I got the go to meetings part, but the don't drink and the taking the suggestions of a sponsor. I got a real softy as a sponsor. You know, he was kind of given to me. He was appointed to me. He said, "You know, this is Elijah. He's going to be your sponsor." And so for, you know, the next 4 months, this guy, you know, would give me rides home after the meeting and listen to me vomit all over the place about how screwed up my life had been and all this other stuff. And God bless him. I mean, he listened every minute of it. But something happened. He went away. I got this new sponsor, and he hadn't worked past the second step. And I found that out real quick. When I got done with my second step, and I said, "I'm done." He says, "Well, I got news for you. I haven't gone past that, so you're going to have to find somebody else." So I found somebody else. And finally, I went 60 days in between without having a sponsor. I'll tell you, it was insane. It was insane. It was like I was about ready to explode. And I finally shared at a meeting. I said, "I don't have a sponsor. I need to find one now." And after the meeting, some guy came up and says, "I'll be your sponsor." And I said, "Well, what would I need to do?" He says, "Meet me here tomorrow night." And then next night, he says, "Okay, we're going through the book." And that's when it started for me. And that's when I got going on my journey in recovery. And since then, it has been an enjoyable ride. Now, what happened, I've got about 10 minutes. what happened, so I still got to get to the part where I got 7.5 years. I worked the steps with this man. It was the first honest relationship I ever had with anybody because I had lied to everybody. I'd always, embellish the truth, would omit things, Of course, I would tell you everything I wanted you to hear, but none of what I didn't want you to hear. And that was a perfect, perfect example of somebody who had, perfected the sin of omission, where I'll tell you what I think you need to know and everything else is just, I'll control that part of it. So, that was probably part of the downfall for me. When I had gone through the steps, I had become fully honest with this gentleman. And I was so scared because there were things on that fourth step that I really didn't want to share. I'd come to believe that I was getting restored to sanity because, those crazy thoughts about going back to California faded away. The obsession to take another drink faded away. All those wonderful things that I never thought would happen. And all of a sudden, I wake up, I celebrate a year, and I'm like, wow, I haven't had a drink. And you know what? My life is 10 times better than I thought it was going to be. My life had literally just, culminated into being repaired. And I got offered this job as an executive chef. And I was like, wow, giving me responsibility again, and here I am at this country club working as an executive chef, and I'm doing all these wonderful things again, and I've got sponsees, and I'm traveling, I'm getting involved in these conferences out there in Charlottesville and everything, and I'm meeting all these wonderful people in recovery, and I've told this man my deepest, darkest secrets, and I felt like that stuff doesn't own me anymore. Such a relief when that stuff doesn't own me anymore. There were some things in there that I just really really made me feel so uncomfortable I just wasn't comfortable in my own skin knowing things that I did. And what happened was I had, of course, gotten into a relationship before I was supposed to at the time. So I wasn't like the perfect example of taking suggestions at that time. But we had a wonderful relationship. Despite everything, my daughter was born, through that whole process, and we were together for 4 years, and then we separated, and I moved here to Richmond and got another job, and I was getting ready to celebrate 8 years, and I had just found I'd gotten ready to marry this other woman, and starting this whole new chapter in my life here in Richmond, and what happens there is I 3 years on the job, I started hating the job, and I didn't want to hear it from her anymore because she wanted me to open up and share my feelings, and I just wanted to come home and just isolate and sit in front of the computer or just not talk. And emotionally I was shutting down. Emotionally I was withdrawing from my sponsor that I had gotten here in Richmond. Emotionally I wasn't attending physically I wasn't attending meetings that I was going to on a normal basis. I cut back to 1-2 meetings a week. And then what happened after that is I got comfortable with it. And then when things went to shambles in the relationship, I pushed her out. I said, you need to go. Because I'm just not, I wasn't happy with myself. It wasn't her. It wasn't a job. I just wasn't happy with myself. And, I could have gotten another job and I could have talked to her, but I chose not to. I had a disease that wanted everybody out of the way so I could do what I wanted to do. And I didn't realize at the time. But I'd been in relapse mode for about 6 or 7 months. And I successfully isolated myself from everything and everyone that had kept me alive and free for so long. And what happened after that was, pretty much predictable. I started hanging out with somebody else that was a drinker, that was going out to these bars, and they were like, come on out, hang out, and you know what, I'll make sure you get your ginger ale and lime, and don't worry, and all that. And that was no big deal, but it was when the neighbor came over with a 6-pack and said, you want one, and I didn't think twice. I didn't even desire a drink. I didn't even think about a drink that day, but I didn't even think twice when it came. Because I was left with no defense against the next drink. No defense, no home group, no sponsor. The 12 steps were the farthest thing from my mind. The gratitude that, all these things that I had gotten back in my life didn't matter anymore. I was just like, one to take the edge off isn't going to hurt, And it's not the first one that always gets me, it's like I forgot that once I get that one in me, that's when the train starts rolling, and after that it was a year and a half of obsession and compulsion and that phenomenon of craving that happened every night, and my first trip to the liquor store, it was 3/5, not one, not a pint, it was 3/5, because I was like, I hadn't had this in years and I hadn't had that, and gosh, what's this, I haven't tried that, and of course I had to drink all 3 of them in one night, So, you know, I was off to a rock and roll start, and within a year and a half, I'd lost everything. I'd you know, destroyed the marriage. I had, you know, basically ran through a slew of jobs. Was living on somebody's couch, the house smelled like kitty litter, and it ended with the same old song and dance. I'm talking to my soon-to-be ex-wife through a 2-inch thick plate glass window, saying, you know, if you can go over there and pay my rent until I get out of jail, it'd be great, because I had gotten pulled over for, you know, swerving all over the road, and they found other stuff in the car, and I was, you know, way intoxicated, but they couldn't prove it because I had so much substance in me that, you know, I could walk a straight line for probably 3 days and they wouldn't know. But so what happened then was I was too ashamed to come back, and I held on. I got out of jail and I held on. I kept on. I'll change jobs. You know, I'll get the job that makes me get up 2 hours earlier every morning. I won't drink. You know, or I get the job where I'm allowed weekends off and I can just drink on the weekends. That didn't work. You know, nothing worked. And the whole time I was thinking, you know, I had such a great life. You know, if I could just get back in the fellowship, and I would go in, and I would duck in, and I would pick up a white chip in a meeting I'd never been to before, and I would leave the meeting, and I'd be like, yes, I'm on my way. Just one drink. I'll go to the bar and celebrate. Just one drink, you know, and then where's Justin for the next 2 or 3 months? I wouldn't be there. But finally, I landed a job, and two gentlemen on the job, my manager and the owner of the store, were years in recovery, and they saw a white chip fall out of my pocket, and they said, when are you going to come back? Are you ready to get sober? And so I made that plunge, and with the help, with the convincing of a couple of alcoholics who knew that I wasn't having any fun doing it, you know, who knew the deal, and I joined my own group, the Jaywalkers, and we're real active, and I show up every time our meeting doors are open, and I have an active service position there, and I sponsor guys, and when my sponsor asks me to do something, I don't even think twice. You know, I'm thorough about my, you know, taking every suggestion, not like picking and choosing the ones I'm comfortable with. And I pray every morning. And I truly mean it this time when I want my defects, you know, God, move these defects out of the way so I can be of use for somebody, you know. And those 9-step promises, you know, they come because, you know, I found the willingness to be thorough about, you know, making amends. And by being thorough, meaning that, like, well, I'll get to that one when I'm okay with it. No, I'm just going to go ahead and just do it. You know, just do it. And if I have any questions, I ask my sponsor. Everything I ever regretted in recovery comes from the fact that I didn't call my sponsor first. That's it. I mean, you know, because left up to my own devices, I have this thinker that will outthink anything else in the world. You know, I will have this uber solution that you haven't heard of yet. And when I come up with it, you cannot convince me otherwise. Because you know what? I've already got what's going to happen next week, next month figured out. And if I do this now, that's what's going to happen. Or I know what's going to get me through right now. You know, and the only thing that has successfully, you know, gotten me through any you know, trials and tribulations sober has been, you know, being a part of, you know, doing the whole AA thing, not just a part of it, being, you know, available for sponsee stuff, being available at my home group, praying, going to my 5 meetings a week, my 5 committed meetings a week, showing up when I'm asked to do something, regardless of how I feel or whether it's convenient or not, because, you know, I drank like hell when it was inconvenient. You know, it was no question. I mean, I did it when it was convenient, inconvenient, when I was sick, when I wasn't sick, when I wanted to, when I didn't want to. So, I mean, what makes me think that I have that option in recovery? It just doesn't work that way for me. And that's the only way I've ever gotten any results from it. I do my best. I have a meeting at 8 o'clock on Thursdays where I go in and I see everybody in detox and I talk to them every Thursday. And I get to see the people that are fresh in every week, and I'll tell you, that's the one saving grace for me, because I get to carry that message to them, and to see even one of them out of every, you know, 10 or 15 that I talk to every week call me after they get out of detox, you know, and for me to be able to pick them up and take them someplace is a blessing. And in the middle of my day when I was thinking, you know, my life is so hectic, you know, when am I going to get time to breathe? Some guy is calling me and it's raining, thundering, showering out. And he's like, I almost took a drink, but I remember what you said and I got your phone number, so I decided to call you. And he was waiting outside the detox and I went and picked him up yesterday. And I took him down to the overnight shelter where they have, it's like a recovery program in Richmond. And I took him down there and he was grateful. And then, you know, we talked about recovery a little bit and hopefully I'll see him in another meeting. But that's what's gained importance in my life over, you know, when am I going to get mine? How are things going to work out in my life? You know, God's always taken care of me. God's always worked out things. Even when I get into my deepest fears of like, how am I going to get through this? It always worked out, you know. When I get out of the way and I talk to my sponsor and I talk to other people and my home group members know what's going on with me, things just happen the way they're supposed to. And I don't have to put my little twist on it. And with that, you know, I'm just so grateful to be here, and I hope, you know, I shared something that might help somebody, but if not, you know, it reminded me where I came from, and that's sometimes, you know, all it takes for me to stay sober for another day is for me to talk about how drinking's affected me. And with that, I hope you all enjoy the rest of your Sunday. I think I'm done. Thanks.